Just listening to Bury Your Cowslip by Sydney Hermont, a new song with flute and guitar and voice. It was recorded and mixed by Sydney over the course of a week in late May, early June of 2020. Sydney's album is due out this summer on Jazz Records, so keep your eyes out for that on your digital screens. Both ArtSpeak and Co-op Radio are located on the unceded and occupied traditional territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. We are very thankful to live, work, and learn on and from these coastal lands as uninvited guests. ArtSpeak Radio Digest Proximities is a group of artists and writers, including Big Rock Candy Mountain, who is Hannah Jickling and Helen Reed, Stephanie Ling, Christina Battle, Stephen Hubert, Sydney Hermont, Dashes, which is a sound collaboration between John Brennan and Elise Ferrari, and Barbara Lazara, Charmaine Lee, and with additional support from myself, Eric Hood, and director-curator of ArtSpeak, Bopa Chai. ArtSpeak is currently closed as to the recommendations of the Downtown Eastside Response, who ask that if you do not live or work in this area, that you refrain from visiting this area. So, tonight on the program, we've given Big Rock Candy Mountain the night off. So, you can look forward to a new bubble broadcast next week here on Proximities. We are very fortunate to have a sound work in two parts from Christina Battle. Battle is an Edmonton-based artist whose artistic practice and research imagine how disaster could be utilized as a tactic for social change and as a tool for reimagining how dominant systems might radically shift. Battle has exhibited internationally in festivals and galleries, and most recently at Latitude 53 in Edmonton, the John and Maggie Mitchell Gallery, also in Edmonton, Harbourfront Centre with Shattered Moon Alliance in Toronto, Capture Photography Festival here in Vancouver, Form Extended at the Berlinale, which is in Berlin, Blackwood Gallery, Mississauga, and Trinity Square Video in Toronto. Tonight's work, Battle describes as, "Birds appear in my work a lot. They're often looming overhead. Generally, they're flat, two-dimensional, and only visible from one plane. Once, at an artist talk, someone asked me about the birds that appear in my work, and I answered something about how I have a bit of a strange relationship with them. I remember people laughing at that, but I didn't mean it as a joke. And now, I've had a strange relationship with birds, or why I never wanted to be a scientist, a sound collage across two parts, and field recordings from Edmonton, June and July 2020. Enjoy.
I was sitting in my backyard the other day, listening to the birds. It sounded like they might be fighting, or at least upset with one another. Or maybe not, I'm not sure. Either way, they were communicating. I just couldn't tell what, or why, or even which birds it was. I couldn't understand them. I've been thinking a lot about the lack of trust with posts online lately, of how easy it is to say a thing without meaning it, of how sound deals with meaning differently than images, and of how saying a thing might be different from showing a thing.
Learning how to understand these sounds can tell you a great deal about the state of affairs in the bird community, giving you a whole new level of understanding of what's happening moment by moment in their lives.
Listen, the world is full of sounds.
Your nose is just a little closer to me than your ears. Light reflected off your nose reaches me just an instant in time before your ears. But suppose I had a magic camera so that I could see your nose and your ears at precisely the same instant.
But where is the bird? Is it in a tree or on the ground? Sometimes your ears are better tools than your eyes.
Brown-headed cowbird, common grackle, common yellow-throat, yellow warbler, Canada goose, American widgeon, mallard, lesser scope, common golden eye, red-necked grebe, Sara Wilson's sniping billgull, American white pelican, red-tailed hawk, downy woodpecker, hairy woodpecker, northern flicker, yellow-shafted, least flycatcher, red-eyed vireo, blue jay, black-billed magpie, American crow, common raven, black-capped chickadee, three-swallow barn swallow, red-breasted nuthatch, white-breasted nuthatch, house wren, European starling, gray catbird, American robin, cedar waxwing, house sparrow, house finch, pine siskin, American goldfinch, chipping sparrow, clay collar sparrow, dark-eyed juncker, white-throated sparrow, savannah sparrow, song sparrow, red-winged blackbird.
I've always had a strange relationship with birds, or why I never wanted to be a scientist.
The very smallest bird on Earth.
Hummingbirds have the fastest metabolisms on Earth. Some need to visit 2,000 flowers a day.
They are hummingbirds, and their glittering colors and their prowess in the air are unmatched.
When I was just finishing university, I tried to get a job working in the field. Tried might be too strong a word. I wasn't even sure if biology is what I actually wanted to do, but I was about to graduate and it seemed like I should try. I just didn't know what else to do, I guess. I had a few interviews, often for jobs where I'd have to work by myself in the middle of nowhere studying a particular species, like mice or trees or birds, and take notes. I don't remember most of the interviews, but one has always stuck with me. It was for a job that had something to do with observing different types of birds, or maybe just ducks. I don't exactly remember. For the interview, I sat alone in the classroom while the project's lead asked me to identify various birds from a series of projected slides. From the beginning, I told her I knew nothing about birds. The only time I had really ever thought about birds while I was in school was for a project where I sat for hours one afternoon watching mallards in a pond at the Valley Zoo. When the first slide popped up and she asked me to identify the bird, all I could think to reply was, "Is it a mallard?" I answered the same, "Is it a mallard?" for the next few slides. Until finally, for the last two slides, I refused to play the game, to waste my time, to continue to suffer the humiliation. Her, what about this one? Me, I have no idea. Her, just try. Me, no answer. Next slide. What about this one? No answer. At that point, I stood up to leave, which she found funny, I guess, because of course that final image was in fact a mallard. That's how I remember it anyways. Meaning seems more fluid across sound, like there's more room. I can say a thing and mean something else. I can hear a thing, but it can be lost without context, diffused across distance. I wonder about where trust lies within sound.
When you hear this, it's not just a noise. It has meaning that the bird is trying to communicate.
So, what are you trying to say?
What are you trying to say?
I can't believe what I'm hearing.
I can't believe what I'm hearing.
These vibrations set up invisible waves in the surrounding air. The speed with which sound waves move depends upon the medium through which they pass.
My neighbors have a Confederate flag up in their back shed. It's printed on a license plate. I can see it from my kitchen every time they open the doors, although they've moved it lower down recently. I wonder about that. It's impossible to not instantly know what it means when I see it.
All sound waves entering the ear are converted into nerve impulses. These impulses are conveyed to the brain by the auditory nerve, the shortest path to the auditory center, which controls the organ and where sound perception or hearing is located.
What happens when a sound makes it impossible to hear certain other sounds? What gets lost in the message? What happens to meaning when sound is too loud to hear completely? When sound travels faster than you do?
Anything that makes a sound emanates sound waves in all directions, moving at the speed of sound. Mm-hmm. Okay? And so you can look at the frequency of that sound, and there's a wavelength
yes.
associated with it.
Yep.
The same thing is true for light waves. Color is to light, precisely what pitch is to sound.
Every species has its different physical variation that helps it make its song.
At certain frequencies, an owl's hearing is 10 times more sensitive than ours.
Each bird can communicate several different messages.
I'm pretty sure this is a robin. Birds appear in my work a lot. They're often looming overhead. Generally, they're flat, two-dimensional, and only visible from one plane. Once at an artist talk, someone asked me about the birds that appear in my work. I answered something about how I have a bit of a strange relationship with them. I remember people laughing at that, but I didn't mean it as a joke.
An ornithopter, a small bird-sized aircraft that flies by flapping its wings. Generally, there are two types, those with engines and those powered by the muscles of the pilot. The smart bird, built in 2018, is modeled after a herring gull and has a 6.5-foot wingspan. It can silently pass overhead and can take off and land in tight quarters. The next advance will be to emulate the way birds change the shape of their wings by overlapping their feathers. In 2011, AeroVironment, Incorporated demonstrated a remotely piloted ornithopter resembling a large hummingbird for possible spy missions. Pocket-sized, it is the first aircraft that has been developed that flies with two flapping wings.
I believe we have an orchard oriole up here, not just a Baltimore oriole. Yep, orchard oriole.
Orchard oriole.
That's what's been singing.
At some point after I started thinking more about birds, I watched a video with Chris Cooper bird watching in the Ramble in Central Park. Or maybe I had seen this video with him first. Maybe this is what got me thinking about birds again in the first place. He's so passionate about them. It feels like I'm surrounded by so many birds all of the time all of a sudden. Maybe I'm just paying more attention to them now.
The DTES Response Fund supports COVID-19 rapid response efforts for the 15,000 people at risk in Vancouver's downtown East Side. Your financial donation helps cover food, hygiene products, cleaning supplies, transportation, and telecommunications. All donations are being received by the Network of Inner City Community Services Society and will receive a charitable tax receipt. Visit their website at dtesresponse.ca. That's dtesresponse.ca.
track you were just listening to was Fulton Street from the 1968 album Eddie Gale's Ghetto Music, released on Blue Note Records. Sadly, Eddie Gale died last week at the age of 78. And before that track, part one of Christina Battle's Sound Collage, I've Always Had a Strange Relationship with Birds, or Why I Never Wanted to Be a Scientist. Stay tuned a little bit later in the program for part two. Now, last October, I had the privilege of reading the stage directions during the public reading and book launch of The Mexican Husband, Un Marido Mexicano, by San Diego and Vancouver-based artist and writer Fabiola Carenza. That play was published by Blank Check Press, and my next guest, Jacqueline Zong Lee Ross, is the person behind that press, and many other titles you should get your hands on, including Art Criticism and Other Short Stories, edited by Helen Reed of Big Rock Candy Mountain, and NASCAR Short Stories by Stephanie Ling. Jacqueline Zong Lee Ross is a writer based in Vancouver on the unceded and ancestral territories of the Musqueam and the Squamish and the Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. Her poetry and fiction and essays and art criticism have appeared in Bomb, Moose, Fence, C Magazine, Kijiji, and elsewhere, and her chapbooks include Mayonnaise from 2016, Drawings on Yellow Paper from 2016 as well. She publishes books by emerging artists and writers and is currently at work on a novel and a collection of short stories and is currently the managing editor of the Capilano Review. Welcome to Art Speak, Jacqueline.
Thanks so much for having me.
Maybe we could start at the beginning of the Blank Check Press Chronicles and how you started and began and what sort of format or structure you had in mind when you first started Blank Check.
Yeah, so it was something that began very informally in 2015 when I had a grant from the BC Arts Council to be in residence at Publication Studio Vancouver. So it was an amazing year where I basically had money to subsist in my expensive home city and make books. And so what I did was I kind of proposed to make these three issues of something I cooked up called Young Adult Journal, I guess. Kay Higgins sort of mentored me that year and taught me how to print and bind books on an old laser, black and white laser printer, and Perfect Binder, which is sort of like a big glorified glue, hot glue machine on a kind of track that you run back and forth along the spine of a book. And then, of course, there's the guillotine, which is the big paper cutter that trims books to size. So that was really exciting, and this journal, Young Adult, was just sort of a way for me to learn that process with some material. And so I started, it wasn't really called Blank Check at that time, I was just making things. I think those projects were published just under Publication Studio Vancouver. But it was really inspiring for me to see how books were made in like a really hands-on fashion. And I think it was something that I took to really easily because I was coming from like a background in visual arts and I was really keen on having the studio practice, but maybe didn't want to paint anymore. Was like failing at ceramics. And I don't know, it was just sort of looking for a way to use my hands somehow and produce something with this productive, enthusiastic spirit that I had. I don't know. And books were just the new avenue for that, that kind of worked out well because I had this interest in reading and literary stuff as well. I guess I'm pretty interested in design, and again, that sort of hands-on like material quality of objects. But I'm also like entirely self-taught. So I learned how to use InDesign basically in the process of wanting to make books, and out of that desire to make books and do it myself. So I guess it's always really funny too, because people sometimes will open a blank checkbook and they'll be like, wow, this is so beautiful. Like, this paper is extraordinary. Where did you get this paper? What is it? Tell me more. It must be expensive. And it's always just like Staples copy paper. So I always find that really funny. I think good design can go a long way. I think the materials are important too. In the past, I've experimented with, you know, maybe outsourcing the printing, or, you know, using different kinds of technology that isn't like the publication studio style, like black and white laser printer and, you know, stamped cover or whatever. And it hasn't turned out nearly as well. I don't know what it is. So like in that process of trial and error, I basically discovered that this whatever is produced when I'm doing these things by hand, as laborious and like annoying at times that it is, it really produces something that's very, very different in the hands than like books that are digitally printed at East Van Graphics or at any, even if I'm spending like way more money on them, they don't turn out nicer for whatever reason. So that's been kind of an interesting epiphany to sort of like come back full circle to this like DIY method and really understand that it's, there's something there that is of value. It's hard to articulate really what it is, because it's not necessarily like such a craft aesthetic or anything like that. Like, I'm not, you know, like growing flowers in my backyard and then grinding them up into like handmade paper. I'm not like, there's nothing like that that's happening. Like, there is something very economical and sort of pragmatic about the way that they're produced, which is very true to publication studios' ethos and publication style. But yeah, there is something there that I think is a little bit different from the books that you find in a store normally. And over the years, I've pretty much found sort of a way to do them somewhat predictably, which is that, yeah, I do use like this, often this cream colored Staples copy paper for the like text interior pages. Always print them in black and white. Who cares? Color is overrated. And then the covers, usually now, at the beginning I was stamping the covers and you just using like a manila file folder or something. So that's exactly what publication studio would do. But over the years I've evolved and I now outsource all of the covers to be letterpress printed at Blackstone Press on Granville Island. And they've been super great working with me. They'll like order in all these different crazy colors of paper. I think for Tiziana Lamelia's book, the second edition that we printed together in 2018, we ordered in like this cosmic orange paper for the cover, and Blackstone printed the title in like silver ink. So hard to photograph, but really cool in person.
Right now at SFU Galleries in Vancouver, an exhibition curated by Karina Irvine, Christopher Lacroix, and Cheyenne Turians, The Pandemic is the Portal, is a show that reveals itself slowly online and on Instagram, with daily or nearly daily writings, visual works, videos, and sound works. You are one such artist that was included in this exhibition. You have a piece of writing called Napping Against Capitalism. And I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about this story, which you've broken into 15 numbered chapters or sections.
Sure. So I guess Cheyenne sent me an email. It's a really nice invitation to participate in something creative during a time when I think many of us may have been feeling uncreative in the height of the lockdown. No, I should say this was kind of like, yeah, the very beginning of the lockdown, I should say, when it was still feeling very fresh. And I've been wanting to write this piece for a number of years, and it had existed on my computer as just a title for like the last 5 years. And I don't know, that's something I often do, where I have like basically a really long list of probably like 100 titles for things, and I just hold them until I'm ready to write them. And for whatever reason that works, it's kind of like a point form. It like signals something in my brain about like what I was meaning to say with that. And so titles often do come first for me. So I was holding this Napping Against Capitalism piece in my mind. And it was really refreshed a few years ago after reading a Tessa Moschweg's novel, My Year of Rest and Relaxation, which actually I think is not a very good book, but it was really strong. Like the elevator pitch of that book is really strong because it's basically about this 20-something-year-old, pretty privileged girl living in New York who decides to like self-medicate in order to like relax away her reality. And so I was just thinking about sort of like the, I guess, the material conditions that would allow a person to do something like that. And also the external conditions that would, you know, even make one fantasize about such a thing in the first place. And was thinking about it and thinking about it. And then finally this invitation came and it was like a great opportunity to realize this thing that I'd been holding for a while. And so, yeah, so I just decided to write this story. It's sort of about a group of unnamed intern revolutionaries who sort of work a bunch of precarious shift jobs and then eventually join this unpaid internship where they're kind of loafing around the edge of a pond and sort of participating in different actions. And then, of course, as the story unfolds, there is like a larger, more sinister plot, perhaps in the background. So this is from chapter 4 of Napping Against Capitalism. The leaders encourage us in our off time to continue the cause. All night long, we build maze-like barricades in the street, obstructing the evening flow of consumers to restaurants, theaters, nightclubs, and airports with the heaps of our tidily rolled sleeping bags, cushioning charging vehicles and obscuring their sense of direction. Taxi drivers look confused as they are sent bouncing back in the direction from which they came. They've already been driving for days, and now this? Will they still be paid for the trip? We gather up our sleeping bags and hurry back to the pond in our striped satin uniforms and slippers in the early hours of the morning, excited about the progress we have made, but increasingly unsure about whose side we are on. The shift worker, the sleeper, the activist, the capitalist. The clogged drain shutters but does not let up. Chapter 5. The water in the pond is the color of bird shit, green with streaks of white or white with streaks of green. And when I think of all the things that could be trapped in it, my head screams with fear. Ming wants to take drugs and dive to the bottom of the pond to investigate, but I'm frightened and quite possibly still dreaming, so I refuse. Eli is sleeping soundly with the others, and I'm afraid of leaving him behind. They tell us that the punishment for refusing to sleep from 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, is a liter of pond water down the throat. Likewise, if you are found to be donning any other uniform but the satin one you are given. The leaders in our group, it turns out, have already drunk their share of pond water, mostly during their time as CEOs and COOs and CFOs of powerful multinational corporations. We try to ask them what led them to join the revolution, but they are evasive. Instead, they show us the calluses on the insides of their cheeks as a warning, making sure to do this right before bedtime. Drink gunk in your dream life, and you'll never have to drink it in real life, they tell us confidently. This, they say, is what gives them their edge.
That was an excerpt from Jacqueline's piece called Napping Against Capitalism, which you can find the rest of it on the SFU Gallery website. Thank you for being here today, Jacqueline.
Thank you for having me.
CFRO 100.5 FM, Vancouver.
And we'll end episode 5 of ArtSpeak Radio Digest Proximities with the second part of Christina Battle's I've Always Had a Strange Relationship with Birds, or why I never wanted to be a scientist. See you next week.
I've always had a strange relationship with birds, or why I never wanted to be a scientist.
Goldfinch, pigeon, woodpecker, blackbird, sparrow, blue jay, blue tit, robin, raven, cardinal, yellow warbler, garden warbler, starling, swallow, wren, mallard duck.
I think this is a robin. I'm pretty sure this is a magpie. I don't know much about magpies, except that they often seem to get a bad rap. They're definitely vocal. I've come across people saying some pretty terrible things about magpies online recently, and right after reading one particularly disturbing tweet, I read an article written by Paula Simons titled, "Why All the Squawk About Magpies?" It's actually from 2011, which is kind of interesting. I guess people's struggle with magpies must resurface year after year. Here's a bit from her article.
"And yet, I find their charm irresistible. They are so clever, so cocky, so brazen, so funny, so interested in everything and everyone. European researchers have determined that they are smart enough to recognize their own reflections as reflections in a mirror, a test of higher intelligence and self-awareness that many primate species cannot meet. They are tough, too. They spend all year here, enlivening our bleak Decembers and Januaries with their bold, iridescent, black and white and blue tuxedo plumage. On a cold and lonely winter morning walk, they make cheeky companions with their cries and stunts. They almost seem to engage you in conversation."
Maybe hearing the magpies again is what got me thinking about birds in the first place.
But where is the bird? Is it in a tree or on the ground? Sometimes your ears are better tools than your eyes.
These news reports are from less than a year ago.
Birds that have adapted to cities and that live in the northern boreal forest are doing well. But a new report shows more than 400 species, a third of North America's migratory birds, are facing extinction.
Taking a walk in your park, are you hearing fewer birds? Here is a startling fact that billions of birds have been lost in North America just over the past few decades.
37% of them are in urgent need of conservation attention.
So these are species that are in serious trouble.
This was interesting. In a report I was listening to about the dramatic decline in bird numbers over the past 50 years. A slip, I'm sure, but makes sense considering how we always seem to frame things.
That over the last 50 years, a $3 billion loss in birds in North America. So that's a 29% decline in population. This is something that they're concerned about, of course, because birds are awfully useful. When you talk about pest control, you're talking about pollination, as well as the spreading of seeds.
It's pretty annoying that we always have to make things all about money, all about us.
It probably happened about 50 million years ago. In the cool climate, plants needed a reliable messenger, and there was a bird that could fill that requirement.
Birds are not aggressive creatures, miss. They bring beauty into the world. It is mankind, rather, who insists upon making it difficult for life to exist upon this planet.
This is the home of one forest creature that has lived here in the Congo for 44 million years.
I've been watching a lot of videos about birds on YouTube. I find them very soothing. I'm learning a lot.
He can imitate the calls of at least 20 different species. He also, in his attempt to outsing his rivals, incorporates other sounds that he hears in the forest. That was a camera shutter. And again. And now a camera with a motor drive. And that's a car alarm.
How to tell the difference between a fake bird call and a real one?
Hovering among the trees at peak foliage in this Massachusetts town is an unfamiliar object, a high-powered commercial drone.
Just about everywhere you look online these days is YouTube footage of drone strikes,
which can fly at 400 feet for up to 220 hours. Sci-Fi is partnering with state police, the U.S. Army, and big events such as concerts and marathons.
On now to an ABC News exclusive on the Predator drone program that has been used to track crowds of protesters in Minneapolis.
This is from the Cornell Ornithology Lab, all about birds. How to listen to a bird song. By using a few simple, objective terms, you can understand the structure and quality of a song and identify what's unique about it. One reason why birders can identify birds by sight is that we have a whole vocabulary for it, words like eyeline and streaking, but how to describe a song? Here are three simple questions that will separate most bird songs. 1. Sound quality. 2. Pitch trend. And 3. Number of sections.
In this case, the thrush is saying, "Hello, I'm here. I'm all right." The common northern cardinal can say, "This means I'm hungry. The children are hungry. Bring food."
Using a spectrogram to display time, left to right, and pitch, from high to low, it's easy to visualize the sound pattern of any bird.
The owl's whole head is designed for listening. Its distinctive round face is shaped like a satellite dish, specifically to detect sound. Sound arriving at the left ear before it reaches the right tells the owl it's coming from below.
The other day, an old friend sent me a picture she had found of a few of us sitting on a park bench at Horlock Park. She said she remembered that day specifically because sometime after the photo was taken, a bird pooped on my head. Some say it's good luck when a bird poops on you. All I know is, as someone who it's happened to a few times now, it's not super helpful to tell someone in the moment when it happens that it's good luck. Maybe save that for another time.
Birds that have adapted to cities and that live in the northern boreal forest are doing well. But a new report shows more than 400 species, a third of North America's migratory birds, are facing extinction.
I keep telling you, this isn't a few birds.
Antigone burrowing owl, Ashetland grebe, Bohemian barn owl, Bermuda flicker, Bermuda hawk, Bermuda night heron, Bermuda sowet owl, braces, emerald, Carolina parakeet, Cuban ivory, billed woodpecker, Cuban macaw, dusky seaside sparrow, gulls, emerald, grand cayman thrush, great oak, Guadeloupe, caracara, Guadeloupe, burrowing owl, Guadeloupe, parakeet, Guadeloupe, parrot, heath hen, Labrador, duck, lesser, Antillean macaw, Martinique parrot, Morges parakeet, New Mexico sharp-tailed grouse, passenger pigeon, slender-billed grackle, spectacled cormorant, Socorro elf owl. Over 190 species of birds have become extinct since 1500, and the rate of extinction seems to be increasing.
Taking a walk in your park, are you hearing fewer birds? Here is a startling fact that billions of birds have been lost in North America just over the past few decades.